Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with the New Books Network, the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of those podcasts. And I'm here today talking with Katya Singel, who has written a new book called From Chernobyl with Love, which is quite a rousing memoir. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, could you start off by telling us a bit about yourself, where you went to school, or what you studied, maybe some background on how you came to write such a book as this?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in California, despite the name Katya. And I ended up going to University of California at San Diego for college. And it was there I saw an This was back in the late 90s, so I saw a print advertisement for a position in the former Soviet Union, and that was where I took my first job in Latvia, and then from there went to Ukraine, and that's where this book comes about. Since then, I've done work mostly as a reporter, full-time and freelance overseas and in the U.S. and Kentucky full-time for a number of years, features. And now I'm based back in California and do freelance and write books and teach journalism part-time at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So your original connection to Eastern Europe, I gathered from the book, was not really long planned. It just kind of happened, right?
Yeah, I had interned at a newspaper in San Diego, and I was going to be graduating. And my plan, as it was to go write scripts in Hollywood, I think, or work as a stunt double. I didn't have a lot of a lot of concrete plans. And then I just saw this ad for newspaper reporters needed in the former Soviet Union, and it just sounded so exciting and a bit of a challenge. And I thought, well, why not? I'll apply. And I think when I applied, I wasn't really thinking I'd get the job. So it was one of those, you're young, you just do something and don't really think about the consequences. And then it happened. And then I thought, well, okay, I don't have any other job offers because I hadn't really applied anywhere else because I still had a little time before I graduated. And I thought, well, I guess I should do it.
I was going to be a studio bass player before I went to college. And here I am as a college professor. So it's those odd career tracks. What in particular, so if your interest in Eastern Europe was kind of unexpected, what do you think it was that drew you to journalism more generally, and, then and now?
Yeah, I think curiosity. Well, I'd always been into writing, and even since I was a very young child, I used to dictate stories to babysitters, so I always liked writing. And then I got into journalism as a way, back when I was doing it, it was a good way to make a living as a writer, never high paying or anything, but more reliable. And once I started in journalism, I was just curious about everything. And so it was a nice match for me. I think Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union in particular, because I did grow up 80s era, it was a mystery. It was closed off. And so it was something I think there I had general curiosity about. I'd never exactly planned to go to that region of the world, but I had definitely as a child growing up, because you heard limited stories from that area of the world, there was this mystery still about it. And even in 1998, when I left, it still, we weren't getting a whole lot of information from there. And because it had been this mystery when I was a child, I think that kind of the idea of exploring fit nicely. And it seemed like a great place to be a journalist, because I felt like there still wasn't a lot of information in the West. We were hearing about that.
I was wondering if I could ask you a kind of general question about, I'm a historian by trade. And as I was reading your book, it occurred to me that the historian's view of things kind of happens from the hot air balloon level. Historians naturally, tend to kind of take the long view. And so I guess what I was wondering is, do you have any thoughts on what historians can learn from journalists who are kind of there on the ground? I'm sure you'll have some stories for us later about being there on the ground. But I was just thinking that, kind of at the theoretical level, where do you think historians could learn some useful things from a journalist kind of perspective?
Oh, that's a great question. I think actually a lot from journalists, you get the real people. So a lot of times journalists are talking to regular people. And I think maybe with historians, and I'm not an expert on this at all because I'm not a historian, but it might be sometimes you're reading more official histories and more top down from government or people in power, whereas the journalists sometimes are just the regular day-to-day people. And it can look very different, because I was recently, there was a talk 30 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall they did at our university, and they had a number of people with experience from around then and the regions and things. And it was interesting to hear kind of the global perspective. And we saw more stories this year at this 30-year anniversary on the legacy of the Berlin Wall and all fall of communism and all these things, that the story we kind of got here in the West, oh, it was great, there was this euphoria, but we missed that it was actually very difficult on the ground for a number of years, almost even a decade for a lot of those countries, as the adjustment, or even in East Germany, how things were afterwards. And I think having those stories where you have more just the regular people talking about in reality what that was like, not the big picture of, yes, there was this euphoria, there was this thing, but what that meant after the big celebration happened, just day to day. Maybe that's the difference, the day to day, I think journalists can get a good glimpse of for historians.
Oh, thank you. I was curious to see what you might think about that. So from that on the ground perspective, then I was wondering if you could just riff for a while on what was it like to be in the Ukraine there in the period you were there, the Orange Revolution and so on.
Yeah, it was. So I was in Latvia in 98. So I think I arrived in Ukraine about 2000, 2003 or so. So in the build up to the Orange Revolution, wasn't there right at the Orange Revolution, but I was there beforehand. What had happened was the President Kuchma at the time had been implicated in the murder of a journalist who had been critical of the government. And so we started launching into these protests, and then those died down, got up again, and eventually kind of led towards that Orange Revolution later. So it was a very interesting time in the country. I think when I was first there, before all those government things, there was just, well, while I was there also, Chernobyl nuclear power plant officially closed, the reactor that was still operating. There were a lot of kind of historic events going on. And then there was also, day-to-day life for people. I think I was in Kiev, the capital, and so you pretty much where I lived in a nice neighborhood. Water most of the time, electricity most of the time, but you go to a couple hours outside the capital, you're still water, electricity shortages, where you'd have some places you'd only have electricity for 2 hours sometime in the night, and water 2 hours sometime in the day, and so people have to be home when the water is on so you can fill up your bathtub so you have water for the rest of the day and you don't always know when that water is going to come on. An extreme unemployment issues and just kind of when things collapsed, it took a long time to build things back up. So I think I was still there in that time when there was a lot of difficult transition for regular people. And in life could be pretty difficult, especially again, outside. Capitals always seem to fare better, but in the more rural areas or even not that rural, but just outside of the capital.
So got any, you know, your book is full of good stories. So you have any, you know, particularly good stories from that period that you'd like to share? Just, you know, interviews you did that you thought were particularly interesting or poignant in some way?
Yeah, I think, well, the book is officially a memoir. I used myself as the hook, but I really wanted to be about some of the really interesting people I met, especially as a reporter. Some just living there, the people I met, but more as a reporter. And I think the strength of a lot of those people is one thing that sticks out. Let me see, ones in particular. I think it was interesting for me, because although I'm not a historian, I always am attracted to kind of oral histories a bit. And there was a survivor of the artificial famine when Stalin basically had created a famine in Ukraine where there was actually food, but it was kept from the people and kind of going with trying to do collectivization and all those things. And I'd read a book, there's some great books on that, but it's still something that because Stalin was alive, no one talked about it. And even after his death, people didn't talk about it. And so survivors of the famine, their stories weren't told that much. So there's not as much awareness of it. And I remember interviewing this woman and her telling me about, she lost her whole family. They all starved to death, except I think she was the only survivor. And then I ended up interviewing another woman whose parents had been enforcing, they had come over from Moscow to enforce the restrictions on Ukraine in such an, I remember asking her, because I was curious, she was a child at the time, if she was aware of what was going on. And I remember to this day, she insists there was no famine and that people just ate bark because they liked the taste of it. And they ate birds because they liked the taste of the birds and no one was starving in it. I don't know if she actually believes that or if it's just the only way she can come to terms with what role her family played in that. It was interesting for me to know. I kept trying to ask her the questions again. Well, you know, and I'd ask specific, like, well, why were people eating bark? Things like that. And she'd just say, well, because they liked it. And I don't know if that's a denial that she even can recognizes or if it's just her way of coping. That's interesting for me. So a lot of the stories were hard ones like that. I think when I went in eastern Ukraine, I did a story about coal miners and I actually went down a mine and then it was interesting for me because the coal mining situation, it was very difficult. There was no money to pay the miners. So sometimes the miners would get paid. One month they'd get a bunch of slippers, another, and everyone would have slippers then. Yeah. And then it's useless because if everyone has slippers, they're worthless because you can't exchange them for anything and you only need so many slippers. So there was this one miner I met and he was really innovative. He actually was raising bunnies so he could pay his miners with bunnies. So at least they'd have something to eat. So he couldn't give them money because there was no money, but he'd figured out, okay, I'll raise bunnies and then they'll have meat and bunnies. And so he was a really interesting guy. And difficult. I remember he wouldn't let me go down the mine originally because I was a woman and women are bad luck in mines, I kept getting told. But eventually he was the one who let me go down one of his mines. I think he also was worried for safety reasons because they do have a lot of safety issues in the mines. He could get in big trouble if something happened to me. But luckily nothing did.
I guess it takes a certain amount of inherent bravery to do these things. So I didn't get the impression from your book that you were too worried about going down there.
You know, looking back, I think I'm not sure if it's bravery so much as extreme youth. I was still in my early 20s, and looking back, I'm like, why did I do that? It's almost that you think differently when you're young. You don't really fully think things through in some ways. On that one, I think I really, when I'm trying to get a story, I'm really into getting a story and seeing the holes. And like, if I'm writing about minors, I really feel I need to, in their conditions, I feel I need to see it. And then it didn't really strike me until I actually was going down it. Wow, do I really want to go down a mine that has really bad conditions just so I can see them? So I think the fear came later because I was so distracted by just getting the story and doing the best job by actually showing what people are going through. And then I realized, oh, wait a sec, what that means. I feel, looking back, I feel most bad about dragging the translator I worked with the most, Sveta, into a lot of these things, because at least I was getting a story out of it. She was just having to do whatever I did and help translate. So she kind of got roped into a lot of things that maybe she wouldn't have liked doing either.
You know, I lived in Vladimir there, a couple hours outside of Moscow, back in the summer of, let's see here. It would have been 2003, I think. And they used to, where I'm headed here is your comments there on mine safety. And I used to watch guys welding without any helmets on, welding a sewer and drain pipes together under the streets. You know, they were just staring straight into an arc welder. And I remember also seeing a guy hanging off the side of a big building in Moscow on this little, it was like one of those seats you see on a kid's swing where you've got a rope through the ends of a 2x6. And he's just sitting there on that thing, like 40 stories in the air. And the lady I was lived with, at the time there in Vladimir, she had this son who was probably in his mid 40s, I suppose. And I mentioned it to him that everybody likes a good OSHA joke, but that seemed perhaps going a little too far. And he gave me this big, long speech, which I only understood a quarter of, about those wussy Americans always so worried about safety and so on. When I read that section of your book about going down in the mine, I was wondering, is that something you kind of noticed? Is that a dynamic there that, you know, things like safety precautions, you know, those are for those wimps elsewhere. You know, is that a cultural dynamic that you saw?
I think there was a little of that, that it was, yeah, life's hard. It's a little more difficult and we can endure it. We're tougher than, Americans who, yeah, even in Ukraine, they would, when I told them I'd lived in Latvia for a while, they were like, oh, they had it easy. Latvia, that was like a vacation. Yeah. So even under, and they were talking under Soviet times, and Latvia wasn't exactly part, but even Soviet bloc countries versus those under, and they were, their idea was they hadn't suffered as much. So there is something also too about this stoic endurance of suffering and pride in that a little bit. I think that is a little of the culture. With the mines, I think there also was, though, there just wasn't materials. There wasn't one of the reasons they were unsafe is they didn't have enough materials to prop them up. There was just, again, the economic situation was so bad that people would take, and then the miners would put up with these things because it was a job, even though it didn't pay. They sometimes got slippers or bunnies, you know, it was something. So I think it was the severe economic depression too that led to some of the risk taking and some of the lack of safety. I think, yeah, and there just weren't the standards. I don't think anyone was really overseeing a lot of that. I remember before I went down in the mine, we were supposed to get the headlamps. And so I just grabbed one and put it on and grabbed some other materials. And then he's like, well, does your headlamp work? One of the miners asked me, and I said, well, I don't know it, because I just assumed if it's a headlamp and it was there in the equipment, it would work. And he's like, we'll turn it on. And it didn't work. And we tried like five others before we found one that semi worked. So there, things just were not here. We'd expect someone would have overseen that and made sure everything, if there was headlamps there, they worked, those kind of things. Everything had just kind of fallen apart a bit, I think. And so there was that. And then there was also that culture of, we're tough. Yeah, we deal. We've survived under, you know, food shortages, lines for all these things. We can endure. We can do this. So maybe, and maybe you don't complain because there's no one to complain to, or there's no way to change it. But yeah, I think there was some of that cultural attitude too.
So I just wanted to make sure it's clear for the listeners. So people were actually stealing the reinforcing timbers out of the mine?
That, no, I don't know if that was happening. There was definitely metal thievery going on. I think there just, there just weren't enough. And I'm not sure why. I think the, I don't think anyone was actually stealing those from the mines. But there was, in the area where I was reporting on coal mining, most of the manhole covers, most any other metal you'd see on the streets had been stolen and sold for scrap metal. You actually had to be careful walking, really look where you're going so you didn't fall through a manhole or anything like that, because so much of that metal had been stolen. I don't think it was actually being taken from the mines. There just wasn't, there weren't enough to even use. And I don't know what that shortage was. I think it was just economic. The mines were in such bad shape. Like the mine guy who owned that one mine didn't have money to pay him. So he didn't have money to buy and replace those and just support the mine as it should have been done.
So kind of on that same theme then, you know, you talk to a lot of people who lived through the, you know, meltdown of the Chernobyl reactor and so on, and were involved in the cleanup. Like, so what's people on the ground? What's their perception of why that happened and how the cleanup was handled and so on?
As for why it happened, I don't think I didn't get into that as much with most people. I got into more, but how the cleanup was handled. I mean, there was so much, I think the secrecy still was so, that was so difficult in so many ways, because you had people, one of the people I worked with, he's from Chernobyl. He was living in Kiev at the time, which is about 2-hour drive away, but his sister, a younger sister, father were still living in Chernobyl, and he had a lot of family there. And he learned about all of it through BBC. You know, no information was coming in or out. Buses weren't coming in and out. Things just stopped. They cut the phone lines. And so I think that still really affects people, how much they were in the dark and how they were lied to. And I think that led to distrust even now on any information you get about Chernobyl and for years afterwards, because how do you trust if you were initially lied to so much? So how do you then recognize the truth, and what do you, that legacy I think was very detrimental when people were finally bust out of Chernobyl, their stories that they tell about when they needed to stop along the way to get water. Residents there not wanting to let them drink the water because they're thinking they're contaminated. So there were all these rumors because no one was giving the facts and things. People just had to rely on rumors, and that then created these divisions too. There was a lot of distrust among the evacuees and the places where they were taken. People tell about whole villages relocated outside, and then the villages had been close before, but then they get kind of split up. One village got split into two, resettled in two different areas, and how even when I was there, so 86, like 15 years later, they still differentiated within one of these villages where part of a village from Chernobyl area had been resettled. They differentiated from the evacuees and the villagers who had been there before, and they still kind of lived separately. And part of it was this fear of whether there was contamination or whatever. And part of it was also this feeling that the evacuees got treated better because they were given new homes, often badly constructed, and they were given special health care and things like that. And so then there was kind of this resentment that they were treated better. So there were just all these divisions. And I think most of that came out of all the lack of information. So then people make these assumptions and make these judgments because they didn't have the right information about what was going on. So that was sad for me to see that all those years later, those things along with, you know, any medical conditions or things, but just that legacy of the distrust and misinformation, how that had played out on everyone. And then I think what was surprising, and I wrote about that a lot and people have heard about it now though, but what's surprising for me was that people still felt such a detachment to the land there, and that there were people who went and moved back in, even though they weren't supposed to. There was an exclusion zone created around the power plant where you were not supposed to live because it's contaminated land. And that even, I think one woman I interviewed, it wasn't even a year later that she moved back. And that was just how miserable she felt outside and how attached she had been to her land that she would do that and move back. I think that was something that always stuck with me. And then also when it was while I was there that they finally shut down, they were still getting Ukraine was getting 10% of their electricity, I think at the time, from the remaining reactor at the plant. And when they finally shut it down, 2000 or 2001, I never thought that people might be unhappy, but I realized because of electricity shortages already and that people who were working there, it was a good job. And I think 1,000 people initially lost jobs. And so they were less worried about contamination or anything than that, like that, than just day-to-day survival. And that they would be losing a well-paid job and they'd have to relocate once again. Because they had relocated after the disaster. And so they lived not in the village right there, but a little further away. And I think that was an element I never thought about from a distance. But up close, when you hear those stories, that was a different element that was also important to hear.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So something that that you mentioned a little bit ago, I thought it'd be worth expanding on a bit. You suggested that, you know, people are kind of stoic about, you know, being lied to about what was happening and so on. And you observed at the end of the book that you thought that folks you talk to in the Ukraine simply expect to be lied to. And your perception is that Americans, have somewhat different expectations. And so I was wondering, maybe this is kind of a loaded question, I don't know, but do you think that's changing? You know, I think of the phenomenon of fake news and so on. I'm wondering if, given your background in the Ukraine there, if you think that American attitudes towards government and press are becoming more Ukrainian in some sense?
I think it was funny. As soon as you mentioned that, I was thinking, yeah, it's been, I think things are changing so fast, and especially just recently. I would think there is less trust now. I think the difference is that we still expect to be able to trust government institutions. So we still, we may not trust them currently and be disappointed in them, but we still believe that it is our right to be able to trust the government and the government works for us. Whereas I think, at least when I was there in post-Soviet, you didn't have that expectation that the government was really there for you or that you could trust it had your best interests in mind. And I think you really trusted people over institutions. And I think we're not quite there yet. I think people still in general believe the government is in general supposed to be trustworthy in looking out for people, and that that's its role. And we still would refer to institutions over people a lot of times. We're questioning it more now, and we're seeing it doesn't always pan out that way, but at core, we still expect it should. I think we're a little more optimistic on that, in that it's still, we believe it's our right to have a government that works for us. And I think when I was there in Ukraine, I think a lot of people had kind of given up on that. They didn't think they had that right. I remember one Ukrainian journalist who worked at an English language newspaper for quite a while, and he wrote later about what it was like for him working around Western journalists. And he talked about one press conference he went to, and a reporter from Reuters, who was a Western reporter, the government spokesperson, had said something, and the reporter questioned them back. And he said he just would have never thought to question them because that wasn't his right to question the government. They weren't there to serve him. They were kind of, it was a different attitude. So, well, I think unfortunately, yeah, we are at a point where our government, we're seeing things we're not happy with, and we do have some distrust. We still, in general, and if you take it over to journalism too, that's why fake news works, is that people in general trust, they don't believe they're being served propaganda. They in general trust whatever they read. They don't look at the source or where it's coming from or how it's being researched. So I think we are more trusting in general and aren't as jaded yet, but maybe we're going to learn to be a little more skeptical and to actually look at where information is coming from and not just kind of believe without questioning.
Yeah. We've sort of moved here onto the subject of some cultural differences. And I was wondering, you mentioned in the book, you spent a good bit of time talking about your now former husband and your relationship in there and so on. And you mentioned that there were some irreconcilable cultural differences. And so I was wondering, as long as we're on the subject of cultural differences, if you might, amplify based on your experience, what do you see as really the most important kind of deep cultural differences between, say, us here in the States and folks in Ukraine or elsewhere in your experience?
For me, and I don't know if it was cultural or if it was also just the timing he was raised, because he had been raised still under Soviet times, and then it collapsed while he was still young, but he had been raised under that, where he definitely had learned to kind of tell people what they want to hear, and the truth was a little more slippery for him on some things I found. And I think that was, it's hard to say culture or also just the system, how the system worked. I mean, there were just certain things. I guess the example is like, I didn't know, and we think of bribery as bad, but it was just how things worked if you needed things to get done. And I had no idea how you actually bribe someone. But I remember I was I had several hospital stays there because I was sick. And at one point, he was my fiance at the time, he was saying, okay, well, we need to give the doctor some money, but healthcare is free. So I didn't know how we pay when we don't, it's free. And so basically you're supposed to kind of, I guess it's a bribe. You give them money, but I'm like, well, do I just slip it in? How do I do this? But he was much more, he used to, you know, it was just normal for him. So he knew how to do that. So he did that. But it was like, I remember when we were coming, he was coming to the U.S. for the first time. And I told him, because he used to speed all the time. I said, well, no, you can't. There's speed limits. And he said, what is that? And I said, well, you go a certain speed, you'll get a ticket if you go over it. And he said, oh, well, because he was a photographer. So he said, well, can I just take the policeman's picture, make him a nice picture? I said, no, you get a ticket. And he said, oh, well, can I just give him money? I said, no, you get a ticket. And the rules, because he was used to in Ukraine, you get pulled over and you give your papers and you just put a little money in with your papers. And that's kind of takes care of it. And it goes, which I guess is kind of like paying, getting a ticket. You just, you pay, decide right there what you're going to pay and pay it. But it just, this little things like that, the systems were so different. But if you're used to that, it just creates different understandings of basic things that I didn't really realize until we tried to think about things. We just thought, approach things on very different levels. And I think also it was, we were both very young and it was his first time out of the country, but it was, you operated very differently there. What was normal, his normal was very different from my normal, how you adjust to a system that doesn't work like that. I think those were, and things like, you know, you didn't put money in a bank. You put money in a book. Of course, that's safer than a bank, and you just to keep it there or under the mattress or whatever. But so those distrusts in the ways you tell things to take care of yourself, how you had to adapt to take care of yourself, I think, was very foreign to me and was difficult for him then when he came here. It was just very different systems. And so today, and so I don't know if we can say cultural, because today a young person who wasn't raised under the Soviet system, I don't know if they would have that same thing, although the transition was difficult too. I don't know what comes from where.
Yeah, going the other direction, I think people might be interested in hearing from you. Just what were the things that you found most difficult to adjust to going to Eastern Europe back in the late 90s and early 2000s coming from California?
Yeah, I think it's hard to remember, but back then there actually, internet, there wasn't much. I learned how to email. And so it was very communication. I didn't communicate with people back home much at all. I didn't have internet at home in Kiev, so I'd send an email maybe from work, and phones were, when I was in Kiev, my phone was bugged, and it was difficult to get calls through back home. So there was much more, that was hard for me. There was much more separation. Now I travel, I don't live abroad now, but I'll travel internationally, and it's just, it's a lot easier now than it was then. Communication is just, you know, you can text someone and you can email almost instantaneously, get information, but it was the distance felt greater back then because connectivity was not what it is today. So that was probably one of the big things. I think it was also a time there weren't a ton of there weren't a ton of Westerners in, there were more in certain areas, but it wasn't, and you get small pockets, but there weren't a ton of Westerners in Latvia or Ukraine. And so that was nice in some ways. I'd go outside the capitals and people would be kind of surprised to see an American and make a fuss over it. But it was also difficult in some ways because you were more alone, especially as a female. There were definitely more men going to Eastern Europe in that region than women. And so there was some loneliness there. And I think some of the other, for me, just being from California, so the weather was definitely different for me in a struggle, especially Latvia, where winter, there's just not a lot of sun and there's a lot of snow and it stays for months on end. So that was different. And I think the understanding how the system works was difficult. You to get a package, you'd go through, like, you'd get a note, then you take the note to one office, and then that office would give you another note. You take to another office, and that go to another office, or to buy something. Stores sometimes still operated with, you'd stand in one line and you'd get a ticket. Then you take that ticket to another line and you'd pay some money. Then, and they'd give you a receipt. Then you'd take that receipt yet to another line. And finally you would get what you were there to buy originally. And I joked how, communism would save everyone from consumerism because they just made it so difficult to get anything. It was like the lack of things, it wasn't as much a problem because you didn't want to shop because it was so difficult. And this was, you know, again, we're talking 8-9 years after the fall, but still this system. And definitely people always said they could tell I was American because I smiled. So there was a little still. I think that was hard for me, that on the streets, people, Ukrainians that have been very friendly once you're in their home and they know you, but sometimes on the streets could feel a little cold to me. People didn't smile at you like Americans will smile and just say hi to strangers, things like that. People definitely didn't do that back then. They'd kind of keep their heads down and their faces pretty, just there weren't smiles. People once said, mark me as American, or they think you were a little slow or simple if you smiled all the time like I did. It was something was wrong with you if you're smiling. So I think that actually was difficult for me because I'm used to smiling. But once you got to know them, Ukrainians especially, very warm and would have you into your house and always offer you something to eat and drink. It was just kind of on the streets that there was just more distance.
Now, have you ever happened to read any of the short stories by Mikhail Zoshenko?
Trying to
the bathhouse. I don't know if that rings any bells. I bring it up because of your funny story about how hard it is to go shopping. And he's got this hilarious story about going to the bathhouse. And he's got a claim ticket for his clothes, but then he's supposed to take the claim ticket with him. He's like, "Where does a naked man put a claim ticket?" You know, and it's if you've never read that story, it's hilarious. Anything by him is good, but he's really good at spoofing exactly those kind of dynamics you were talking about, which seem, as you said, to have survived well into the post-Soviet era.
Yeah, no, I definitely have to. That sounds familiar, but I can't say. But yeah, there. I think humor is one of the great things that came out of the Soviet system. Actually, there was this dark humor that I find. Really, it's a way people survive, I guess, when things are totally absurd and don't make sense, like being given a claim ticket when you're nude. That happened all the time. And so you do develop this great sense of humor, and people have that still, which I appreciate that sense of humor.
There's been some pretty interesting academic work done on Soviet jokes and humor in recent years, can kind of a small cottage industry. I wondered, we got about 10 or 15 minutes left here. I'd wanted to get back to some of the events you observed happening on the ground there in the Ukraine back in the early 2000s. And yeah, you spent a lot of time in the book talking about, you know, that murdered journalist and the various political players and so on. Wait, what was your impression of people on the ground? Like, did they have a sense that there were good guys and bad guys? Did they have a more cynical sense that everybody with power was untrustworthy? Because, you know, it takes a certain amount of optimism to get involved in a protest, right?
Yeah, and I think it was interesting. Some of the younger people, a lot of the protesters, when they would do this camp where they'd actually sleep out in tents downtown. And some of the younger ones, they were college age. I saw a lot of hope in them and thinking they really could change things. And so that was interesting. then you would see, I think the older, usually the older ones were, I guess it makes sense anywhere you see that, but were more jaded and more scared, a lot more fear from them that about what the government would do. So it was more the younger ones that had that hope and less fear. They were willing to speak out and do those things because a lot of the older people and older, even just middle age and such, were still just too scared to voice things. And for a good reason, there were, I remember one story I did was there was a protest and then I'd gone home, I'd covered the protest, nothing really big had happened. But then later I got a call from my editor saying she was hearing reports that the protesters had later been beaten up and were now in hospitals and things. And so then we went, I went with the translator I was working with, Sveta. We went to some of the hospitals to try and see if this was true or not. And we couldn't get people to talk to us because there were guards at the doors and things. And then we finally got this one doctor who would say what he could tell us is that their wounds were consistent with having been beaten with baton, you know, like basically backing up that the injuries of this many people coming at this time with this were probably from batons. And at that point he said, you know, I'm going to be fired now. And said, yeah, because I realized, you know, if he's telling us this stuff, he's losing his job. And he kept talking. And so he just wanted us to know that, but he was willing to take that risk. But that was very rare because people knew what was going to happen if they were going to talk out. They were going to lose their job. And jobs were hard to come by. And so it was a big risk to take. So I think you wouldn't see, it was easier, I guess, when you're young, if you're a student and you don't have a job or a family or those responsibilities as much, and maybe you haven't experienced as much of the repression of under Soviet times because you are younger still, that you were able to do that. But so there was a mix. There was that younger hopeful, and then there was the fear, and then the people who, even knowing the consequences, were willing to speak up. And then when I was there, there was kind of, with the group, there was hopeful protesters, and then there was kind of the muscle group, which were kind of, I call them almost thugs, who kind of provided they would be there with walking around at night with baseball bats and things and kind of protecting the area. And there was an uneasy truce between these two groups because they both wanted the change, but one was much more nationalistic and militaristic, and the other was more youthful, hopeful, academic university students. So even within protests, you would see that. And then you would see some who would come during that time from other parts of Ukraine to take part in those protests and stay. It was kind of this camp. They were all camping out. And they usually, it was more the people in Kyiv, I think, who would start it, but you would see some come in from those other places. So I guess it wasn't, there were different factions within even the protesters.
How do you think those different factions envisioned, you know, what they wanted to happen in the future? Like when the muscle bound nationalist crowd, as you call it, there, when they're envisioning what we want to happen, how does that look, and how does that look different than the more youthful set that you observed?
At the time, the muscle faction was definitely, I think, more nationalistic, really wanting almost, I don't know how to say it, not democracy so much. They were less forward thinking, a little more backward thinking, not backward thinking, but wanting to return to a time of national greatness, maybe from a prior independence or something, and more, less interested in fitting in with Western Europe or with the larger world in general, whereas the younger, more college student ones were more interested in fitting in with the West and being very progressive and being very democratic. And so I think there were really big differences there on how they fit in with the world more. The nationalistic ones a little more inward looking and the young ones more outward looking. But it was kind of hard to say because they were all just kind of, their big thing was just getting rid of Kuchma, who was the president at the time, and the corruption and the brutality of protesting, you know, that this journalist had been, Grigory Gonkadze had been beheaded, and then the government had been implicated in that killing and was still denying it. So it was more focused on just getting rid of that, and you didn't know as much what their plans were for after, but you did get this one hope that it was much more democratic and more Western leaning. And I think that's the problem with Ukraine. It's always got these push and these pulls of the different players trying to gain traction in the country.
What's your assessment then of that period? You know, for with the benefit of hindsight, you know, we're, you know, 15 years or better since then. I mean, do you think, have any of those groups' hopes been fulfilled to some extent?
Well, it's interesting because you got change, you got a new government, and then you got another one, and then it kind of, that government, there were still corruption kind of haunted it, and even the good guys then got involved with bad things, and then you got pressure from Russia again and pressure from the West. And I think there's just been, no one's quite lived up to the hopes. There's definitely been disappointment, but there are some good signs. Some of the youth, especially now, you've got youth who grew up post-Soviet. They don't remember Soviet times because they weren't alive then, who are really trying to do something about the corruption and really trying to change the country. And I think the problem is right now with all the politics we have going on the U.S. side, where Ukraine's come in, we kind of are painting just the corruption in Ukraine. And yes, definitely it's there, but we don't look at the people who have made a lot of strides changing that and fighting that, and the younger people who are really trying to build a different kind of country. So I think there is still some hope there, and there has been some change, and there will be more change. But I think it's a difficult situation. When I was there, you still had Ukraine had Eastern Ukraine and had Crimea, and now Russia has Crimea, and Eastern Ukraine is a basically open battlefield. It's still being fought over. So much has changed, and leadership is still being pulled between, you know, the U.S. and Russia are still using Ukraine in our politics and kind of getting it involved in that and pulling it in. And I think that it's just a very difficult situation for the country.
So we got time for about one more good question here. And what I was wondering was, you know, your book is, you know, chock full of really interesting stories, interesting people, and so on. And so I thought maybe, what's the best story that you, looking back on that period, that you haven't mentioned so far? One really fantastic person you ran into, or one really wild event you saw firsthand? I thought that might be a good way of closing our talk here.
Yeah, let's see. Oh, so many. Well, we could talk about the retired dancing bears of Bulgaria. Not people, but they're bears. And totally changing the subject. But that was, I had done a story about in Moldova. And another journalist had asked me, who was based in Bulgaria, an American, had asked me some questions about that, and I'd helped him out a little. So then he said, oh, by the way, we have this retired bear sanctuary it was having an anniversary, or it was opening or something in Bulgaria. You want to come report about it? And so I thought, oh, that's great. I'll just fly to Bulgaria and write about bears. And so ended up going and flying to Sofia, Bulgaria. And then we went out to this sanctuary, and it was the actress Brigitte Bardot, famous model and actress from a different era, had decided to build a sanctuary for bears who had been, they have a chain in their nose, and then they're kind of made to, quote, dance. And for people get money from that and things. And usually it was more the Roma, or what's sometimes called the gypsy community, had used the dancing bears. And so she decided to give the owners of the dancing bears money so then they can give up their bears, and then the bears bask in retirement. And we went to this village, and the people are complaining that the bears in the village eat better than they do. There were broken windows on the schools, but the bears were getting watermelons and oranges. And so it was this contrast. And then I think my favorite quote, though, was when we interviewed one of the men who had given up his bear and gotten money for this. So, you know, they told him it was no good to have your bear dancing, animal cruelty, all these things. And so they gave him some money. And I said, well, so what did you do with the money? I said, I bought a monkey, and now he's got a dancing monkey. So it was, you know, interesting how things played out, how you want them to figure, and how what happens in reality. So it was kind of a fun little story, but it also it showed deeper cultural things too, even within the story just about dancing bears. It was fascinating, the dynamics of that. And I don't know, it's been a while now. I wonder if the sanctuary is still there, and if the bears are still having their retirement.
Still eating the watermelon.
Yeah. Yeah. As one of the villagers said, it would be better to be a bear in this village than a human.
So what, maybe the last thing here, what are you working on next?
I think I'm working on another nonfiction about juvenile psychiatric institutions, but I'm not sure how it's going, but that was kind of what was interesting to me right now, and we'll see how it pans out.
Well, that should be a good read. Your book here was certainly full of good stories, so I'm sure that one will be too.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well thanks for taking the time to chat with us about your book. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You bet. Bye now.